Hello, everyone. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5, www.ciut.fm. I'm your host today, finally, after a long hiatus.
Welcome back, Rob.
Thank you. It's been probably a few months since I've been in the studio, actually. I've been working on an online fitness site. Some of you know I'm a personal trainer and fitness instructor around Toronto. And so I posted a bunch of free fitness videos online.
Cool.
Have you seen? You haven't seen yet, then?
No.
You'll laugh your ass off.
Yeah. Oh, no.
So it's for people at home who you know, don't want to go to a gym, but still want to get some activity in their day. So if you feel like working out at home, which you may want to do after hearing today's show, you can take one of my fitness classes at rbyfitness.com. All right, I'm done plugging myself.
Yeah, good job, though. It's really cool.
And why will you want to work out after today's show, you might be asking? Well, because it's not every day you hear from the course record holder and consecutive seven-time champion of the Western States 100-mile endurance run, course record holder and defending two-time champion of the Badwater Ultramarathon, and the first U.S. runner ever to win Greece's famed 246K Spartathlon. I'm talking, of course, about world-class vegan athlete Scott Jurek. We'll hear how he got into veganism, how that helped his athletic performance, and his advice for all you aspiring vegan athletes out there. Then Dr. Annette Larson-Meyer will join us. She is the author of Vegetarian Sports Nutrition, which is hot off the presses, for which Scott coincidentally wrote the foreword, actually. Dr. Larson-Meyer will give us vegetarian-specific advice for enhanced muscle recovery, optimal bone health, improved athletic performance, and also answer your questions. First, I'll read a couple news items today. I won't read too many since we do want to get on with today's show. First, from MSN.com. A fun article for a lot of you, I think. As a child's IQ rises, his taste for meat in adulthood declines, a new study suggests. British researchers have found that children's IQ predicts their likelihood of becoming vegetarians as young adults, lowering their risk for cardiovascular disease in the process. The finding could explain the link between smarts and better health, the investigators say. The report is published in the December 15th online edition of the British Medical Journal. We know from other studies that brighter children tend to behave in a healthier fashion as adults. They're less likely to smoke, less likely to be overweight, less likely to have high blood pressure, and more likely to take strenuous exercise, said lead author Catherine Gale. This study provides further evidence that people with a higher IQ tend to have a healthier lifestyle. In the study, Gale's team collected data on nearly 8,200 men and women aged 30 whose IQ had been tested when they were 10 years of age. The researchers found that 4.5% of participants were vegetarians. Of these, 2.5% were vegan, and 33.6% said they were vegetarian but also ate fish or chicken. There was no difference in IQ score between strict vegetarians and those who said they were vegetarian but who said they ate fish or chicken, the researchers add. The study did not, however, take into account the diet, environment, or parental influence of the children as they grew up. And as the weather gets cooler for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, I'd like to read a quote from a Friends of Animals press release in which they call for an immediate end to the fur industry. While the industry is reinventing itself with terms like eco-fur, Daniel Hammer said, animal advocates have no time to waste on cheeky stunts or on husbandry reforms. Humanity can and should outgrow the obsession with proving we can dominate other animals. The sale of fur, for everything from boots to coat trimmings, is a particularly obvious and showy sign of this fixation. No matter what methods or practices are employed in the production of fur or what animals are being skinned, we call for the outright end of this practice. Amen. And finally, the devastating news that past guest of Animal Voices, Virgil Butler, has died at the age of 41. In a press release from the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Virgil first contacted PETA in 2003 to blow the whistle on rampant abuse that he had witnessed during more than 8 years on the job at Tyson Foods. He worked tirelessly to expose cruelty that included blowing birds apart with dry ice bombs, intentionally scalding them to death by the thousands, and breaking the legs of large chickens in order to fit them into shackles that were too small. Virgil also worked closely with PETA to call for prosecution of those responsible, including speaking out at a press conference, recording a video, going undercover to videotape inside the plant, and writing a comprehensive statement detailing the sadistic cruelty he witnessed at the Tyson plant. We're joined now by Scott Jurek, and I'll list his recent titles again. Course record holder and consecutive seven-time champion of the Western States 100-mile endurance run, course record holder and defending two-time champion of the Badwater Ultramarathon, and the first U.S. runner ever to win Greece's famed 246K Spartathlon. Scott, are you running right now?
As we speak.
Yeah. just to be sure.
Not as we speak, but I am started back into training. I always take a downtime during the winter for at least 6, sometimes up to 8 weeks. So I'm just getting back into the base building phase and getting ready for next year's season.
All right. Well, welcome to the show. It's really a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
For those of you listening, feel free to call in and ask Scott your questions about him or sports nutrition at 416-946-7000. Scott, I'll start with a question that's probably on most minds out there. I think it takes, I can only imagine it takes a lot to win a 100-mile race, psychologically, physically, great support team. But do you really think a vegan diet has helped you win so many races?
I truly do. I know there's a lot of runners out there and a lot of athletes who think, well, you know, they see certain athletes perform on, you know, subpar diets. And with my experience, I've been there. I used to eat at McDonald's and fast food, you know, 2 to 3 times a week. And I didn't grow up in a household that, you know, we valued home-cooked meals, but I didn't grow up in a vegetarian household or a household where, you know, we ate a lot of whole foods. And so I've seen the transformation over the years, and it wasn't like this quick changeover where all of a sudden, as soon as I started eating vegetarian and then vegan, that things just changed night and day. It was a gradual transition, but the biggest area where I've seen it help me with performance has been in recovery. And in order to do the events that I do, I'm taking my body to the extreme levels through training, and in order to build back and repair from all of that basically tearing down and stressing the body, a vegan diet that is whole foods based, that incorporates high quality nutrition, has been paramount, I think, to my success and allowing me to, you know, turn around 2 weeks after Western States and perform as well as I did at Badwater and set a course record, or, you know, be able to year after year improve my time at Western States 6 consecutive years.
Well, let's talk about that transition that you made to, I guess, first lacto-ovo-vegetarian, then complete vegan. Talk about that process.
Sure. As I mentioned, you know, I grew up in a household that, bless my mother, and, you know, she was great. She had us cooking in the kitchen at a young age and, you know, has really instilled some great values in terms of, you know, making home-cooked meals. But I grew up in a household where, you know, meat was the centerpiece, and meat and potatoes, and I grew up hunting and fishing. And so for me it was, I started in college realizing that I needed to change my ways. Like I said, I ate fast food several times a week, and was even eating in the cafeteria at school and college, and It wasn't actually until I met my wife, and I always have to tell this story with a, it's kind of hard to admit, but I actually, our first date, she ordered a bean burrito, and I said, "You're not a vegetarian, are you?"
So you didn't
I do
that.
Like to
oh
tell that
gosh.
Story, and, you know, the fact that I used to eat fast food, because it wasn't like I had this, you know, growing up and, you know, grew up in a hippie household where, you know, this was just an easy transformation. It took some time. And I think for me, the biggest thing was, you know, I read a lot. I was very interested in cooking and being in the kitchen. And for me, it was this, this new path of exploring all these great foods. And for me too, I used to hate vegetables. I, you know, carrots and, corn were like my mainstay when I was a kid.
Yeah,
so,
me too. Actually,
you know, eating
yeah.
green vegetables was not something I was used to. And, when I started attending cross-country ski camps in high school, I learned the value. We had a great cook at the hostel where the camp was held, and really learned that, you know, vegetables are great if cooked properly. And for me, it was this whole new way of just cooking, as well as, you know, a different lifestyle. And for me, it was initially a health, a health transformation. And I didn't see it as something that was going to drastically affect my performance. I was looking at long-term, you know, going through physical therapy school, working in hospitals, and seeing just the downgrade in the quality of life and nutrition and the role that it can play.
And so was Lee a vegetarian when you went on your first day?
She was not, but she ate, a mostly vegetarian diet. She grew up eating, you know, some amounts of fish and such, but she just tended towards eating mainly vegetarian, you know, a majority of the meals per week.
And then what hurdles did you discover on your way to finding the right foods that would properly affect your performance? Like, did you find that some people are afraid if they go vegetarian or lacto-ovo-vegetarian or vegan that they find, they won't have enough energy, they won't be getting enough protein, they won't have good performance?
I guess the benefit for me is I made the shift to vegetarian, you know, slowly. I went incorporated fish a couple times a week and then gradually went full lacto-ovo. And then it wasn't actually for another year and a half that I became vegan. And after reading Howard Lyman's Mad Cowboy, I just truly realized, okay, I've got to, you know, shift. And so for me, I think that the biggest help that your listeners could take from my experience was that don't try to go too drastic, especially as an athlete. It's hard sometimes to make that shift. And for me, that gradual shift, and what I tried to do initially was, you know, explore the options as well as, you know, really read up on things. I think a lot of times it's easy to eliminate, and this is my big thing when I'm talking, you know, with clients as well as other, you know, future vegetarians and vegans. Try not to think so much about just elimination from your diet. Think of what you're going to incorporate in terms of new foods to replace those foods. So I think it's all too easy just to say, well, I can't eat that, I can't eat that, and then you're left with, like, whoa, there's nothing left to eat, when in fact there are a lot of options out there.
Yeah,
I guess, you know, expanding my viewpoint and horizons on, you know, what types of foods could I incorporate to replace dairy, or a lot of times, you know, it's the cheese for vegetarians that try to shift to vegan diets that is the real hurdle. And for me, it was, you know, incorporating and finding other foods to replace those.
It is a learning process for sure. And I just want to remind our listeners, our number is 416-946-7000 if you have any questions for Scott, or you can also post them at animalvoices.ca. And this was back in 1998, right, that you went completely vegan?
Yeah, it was, like I say, I had some running friends who introduced me to Howard Lyman's book, and you know, just it was one of those things where I realized, you know, gosh, you know, I've moved in a great direction, and got really inspired by Andrew Weil's books on nutrition, and I read a ton of different cookbooks. I was always playing with, you know, things in the kitchen, and then after reading Lyman's book, it was really evident to me that I needed to make another shift. And from the standpoint of a health reasoning with a saturated fat in dairy products and such, but also just the environmental impact. I mean, that just really opened my eyes in regards to living lighter on the land, and, you know, just being able to enjoy the places that I ran and trained, and for future generations. I just think as a worldwide population, we're going to have to shift towards at least a majority of the time eating vegetarian.
It is incredible what animal farming is doing to the planet, and the desertification that's going on in the world because of deforestation, and then the poverty that's, that then results from that. It's really quite amazing. We'll cover this in a future show as well, for sure. And we'll talk more about food and what you mentioned about recovery when Dr. Larson Meyer joins us as well. But I want to ask about your athletics as well. I mean, it takes – not everyone wants to run 100 miles in a row, and you do it regularly, and you're, the fastest on the planet, so it seems. So why do you do it?
That's the big question always.
Yeah.
And I wish I could sum it up in one sentence. I guess the biggest – and it's kind of changed, just much like my path towards becoming a vegetarian and then vegan. It's one of those paths where I think – being vegetarian and vegan, as well as ultramarathoning, has really just opened up the way I look at life, the way I look at myself, and I look at it as a self-exploration. And, you know, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, if you had asked me why ultramarathon, I might have said because, you know, I love the challenge, and, you know, I love seeing where I can bring my body in terms of athletic performances, and, you know, I love being out in nature, and I all of these things are valuable to me, but as I have, I guess, matured in the sport and realizing, after a while, winning events like Western States, although, you know, it's like one of the premier ultramarathon events, you get to a point where, you know, winning isn't everything, and something else has to drive you, and I found that self-exploration and finding out, you know, who I'm made of and what my body can do has really been the main reason.
And do you have, like, a training philosophy that propels you through these races? Like, what's going through your mind when you're, you know, crossing mile 88? I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to say I love working hard. I grew up in a family where that value was instilled, whether it was, you know, chopping wood and doing stuff around the home. My mother had multiple sclerosis when I was a young child growing up, and so we had to take on a lot of duties at home, and I was always taught, you know, to work hard. And so ultramarathoning, even though there's not a lot of rewards out there in terms of, you know, money and fame and fortune, I guess I love working hard, and late in those races, even though there's a lot coming from my mind saying it's too far, it's too hard, you know, gosh, you've won Western States enough, or, you know, you've done enough, you know, what else do you have to prove? There's something that drives me, and once again, what is that? It's hard to say, but I get little glimpses of it when I compete, and I think that's what keeps me going back and keeps me going at, you know, mile 80. What can I achieve, and what's the next thing I can do?
What training advice do you have for someone who wants to run a marathon? Everyone thinks about, oh, I'd love to run a marathon one day.
Yeah.
Where would they start?
Or even just, you know, running, you know,
down the block.
Miles. I think, you know, yeah, down the block. You know, I used to hate running, and I tell this to a lot of people because, you know, look at me now. I'm running 100-mile races. So once again, it's being open and just letting that constant evolving occur. Don't. I think sometimes we stop ourselves short and say, "Gosh, okay, you know, I've done that, or you know, I've given that a shot," but you know, let things kind of evolve. And with training, I think keeping an open mind, as well as listening to the body. I think a lot of times when people, you know, train for their first marathon or, you know, just start running, they tend to, you know, want to jump in things really fast and quickly, and they don't pay attention to injuries as they're starting to form. And for me, it's been about making sure that my body can recover and rebuild itself. And that's where with the, you know, vegan diet, it's been important, as well as just paying attention to little things. How does my body feel, and how is it changing? And I think for beginners, that's very important. You don't want to wait until you can't run, period, or, you know, you're running with a limp before you take care of something. I think also, too, for motivation and inspiration, try and connect with folks that, you know, are doing something similar to you, whether it's, you know, cycling, running, or whatever. But gaining motivation once a week and training with some training partners or a group can be very helpful, as well as a learning process, too. You can read a lot and you can have a coach, but I think learning from your peers is very important.
And I'm curious if weight training is part of your regimen as well.
Yeah, my training really consists of, I like to call it whole training. It's not just going out and doing these mega long runs or just looking at how many miles or kilometers I cover on a daily or weekly basis. I have really found the value in strength training, so I'm usually strength training anywhere from 2 to 3 times a week. I definitely am a firm believer in incorporating flexibility exercises. I think some runners think, okay, they've heard about the stretching and flexibility as an important piece, but they forget about the strength training. They just assume, well, I'm working my legs hard enough, and they're probably getting plenty strong. And as a physical therapist, I found a lot of runners to be very weak in their lower body as well as upper body. So the strength training has really taken my running to a new level. I also incorporate yoga as another piece, once to twice a week, depending upon the time of the year. And then in terms of my run training, a lot of people must assume I'm running like, you know, 200 miles a week, and typically peak out at anywhere from 100 to 110 miles a week. So I'm not doing these super mega mileage weeks, but my big runs come on the weekends where, you know, I might run for 35 miles on the trails and it might take me 7 hours.
And I'm curious, does it help you to do like interval running as well as endurance running?
Yeah, I am doing a combination of, you know, speed, incorporating tempo runs, which are done at the lactate threshold, kind of like a 15K race pace for those who are trying to equate that pace. And those are typically anywhere from 6 to 8, as well as up to 12 miles sometimes. And I do those sometimes as hill repeats. So I'll run up a mountain climb that might take 4 miles, for instance, and run those close to that level. I do get on the track once a week as well, and I'm a firm believer in doing speed work. So I'm training, you know, very similar to, I guess, maybe a lot of marathoners, but at the same time, it's the weekend days where I'm running, you know, 4 hours to 5 hours one day, and then turning around the next day and, you know, spending, you know, 7 to 8 hours out on the trails.
Mm.
So I'm doing these, like, back-to-back days that simulate what does it feel like to be at mile 70 in a 100-mile race.
Yeah. And see, I'm asking a lot of these questions just for my own benefit, because
sure.
I really dislike running. But I can see myself wanting to engage in this type of race at some point in my life, and I think, well, how will I eventually like it if I don't like it now?
Yeah, and it's not always running. You know, with these 100-mile trail races or 50-mile trail races, or there's some great 50Ks out there, running on the trails, and that would be another point I guess I would make to your listeners who maybe only run 3 to 5 miles a day or they're running for a marathon, get on dirt as often as you can, even if it's a smooth gravel path. If you can get on dirt, mix that in with your pavement. I mean, I live in downtown Seattle almost, and so I'm on the pavement a fair amount, but if you mix in dirt a couple runs a week or on your long runs, every other long run, that definitely helps. As well as with the trail events, most people are hiking the uphills unless you're trying to win the race, and then running the downhills and flats. So we see a lot of mountaineers and climbers and backpackers and people who love the outdoors that come to the sport of ultramarathoning because, you know, they've done the 20-mile-a-day backpack trips, and they're like, gosh, you know, I think I could run, you know, 30 miles without a pack on my back with a combination of running and hiking. So it's really quite an interesting sport. You don't have to be this, you know, typical marathoner who all of a sudden finds the sport of ultramarathoning as a new challenge.
And for the for not running on pavement and using dirt instead, is that because of the impact?
Impact forces, and if you think about it, I mean, our bodies were not really designed to, you know, pound concrete. And, you know, of course, asphalt's better than concrete, but it's definitely for the ground reaction forces and the forces on the joints. And that's why, you know, strength training is so important, so that you can absorb the shock from the running forces that are created. So it's generally for that, as well as variety. And when you're on a trail, typically you're having to change how your foot lands as well as how your body reacts to the various surfaces. And in running on the roads, it's one continuous type of surface the whole time.
In your sport, are people generally open to veganism, or are people still sort of, what do you think you're doing?
Actually, it's I don't like to, you know, say that I'm changing the world of ultramarathoning as well as running, but I'd have to say the more athletes that excel on a vegan diet, it gains more validity as well as respect. And people actually become inspired. I mean, I get emails every day from folks that, you know, I'm interested in transitioning to a vegan diet, or you've really inspired me to continue with a vegetarian diet. And I have folks who probably aren't going to become full vegetarian, but they're interested in incorporating more vegetarian, quote, you know, foods, as well as just, you know, eating vegetarian a couple times a week, or not placing an emphasis on meat as the centerpiece of the table. And you know, I meet runners across the country, not just ultramarathoners, but just, you know, marathoners and, you know, fitness runners who have been inspired. So I think the more folks we can get out there who are doing great things in any sport and showing that it can be done, as well as, I think, not being so, how do I say it, not cramming it down their throat and saying, oh, you've got to become vegetarian, just leading by example. And that's where I've always tried to to show other fellow athletes as well as fitness enthusiasts as well as the general population that it doesn't have to be this burden. It doesn't have to be this diet that sounds just devoid of any flavor and fun. You know?
Right, yeah.
It's not, you know, eating twigs and berries like people envision, or, you know, what do you eat out there?
Indeed, indeed. We'll talk more about food after the break. I want to give you like 10 seconds to plug Beyond Running.
Sure. What
you can take 20. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I've done with Beyond Running is it's a coaching and camp business that my wife and I started, and you know, with my training in racing, I've tried to keep it still relatively small. I do phone consults over the phone with folks across the country as well as Canada if they want advice on their training as well as you know, sports nutrition to bring their training to a new level. And we also have put on trail running camps where the full basically diet during the camp is vegan. And it's been really fun to see folks who have never eaten vegan for a day, let alone 5 days, come to the camp, and they're really inspired after they leave. So it's a lot of fun.
Awesome. You can find more info about that at scottjurek.com. And you can ask questions for our guests at animalvoices.ca and find more info about today's show. We're going to take a short break and be joined also by Dr. D. Annette Larson-Meyer. Don't go away. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We are now joined by Dr. D. Annette Larson-Meyer, Assistant Professor of Human Nutrition at the University of Wyoming, where she also serves as Director of the Nutrition and Exercise Laboratory. She is a registered dietitian with training in exercise physiology and has experience working with vegetarian and non-vegetarian athletes. Her research focuses on how nutrition and metabolism influence the health and performance of active people. She is also the author of the brand new book, Vegetarian Sports Nutrition. Annette, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be on the show.
And for our listeners, we're also speaking with Mr. Scott Jurek, amazing vegan ultramarathoner who's won too much that I can't repeat it again. It's actually interesting that I was planning on having both of you on together before I actually knew that Scott had written the foreword to your book, so that was a nice coincidence.
Absolutely.
Let's get the protein question out of the way, because everyone out there is, you know, thinking, well, how can you get your protein on a vegan diet? It's probably the number one question we all get, right? So maybe specifically for the vegetarian athlete, do we need more protein than non-athletes, and do we need more protein than non-vegetarians? Annette, I'll ask you that.
Actually, you know, honestly, protein really isn't a problem. I think the problem, well, I guess you're asking, first of all, let me answer your question. That athletes in general, the needs, most people agree, are slightly higher for endurance than strength-training athletes. And then the question is, some people think that if you are consuming predominantly plant-based foods, that perhaps the amino acids aren't as adequately absorbed as are, you know, just maybe some more processed, like maybe from soy straightforward. But really the verdict isn't out, and when they were redoing the dietary guidelines, they didn't decide that there was enough evidence supporting that vegetarians did need more protein than non-vegetarians. But for athletes, they do need slightly higher. It's not quite double the needs of the sedentary person, but they are slightly elevated.
Yeah, and what is the recommended daily allowance?
The recommended daily allowance is 1.2 to 1.4 grams per kilogram of body weight per day. So you have to take your weight and figure it out in kilograms for those of us who live in the United States, which is just dividing it by 2.2. And then for strength athletes, it's 1.6 to 1.7 grams per kilogram. And sort of to reference that, the recommendation for sedentary non-athletes is 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight.
And I know some people out there are still concerned with having to combine proteins, but that's kind of old science. Is that right?
Yeah, and, you know, it's definitely old science. I think the answer to that question is if you are not working out, you know, doing really intense training, it's definitely, you know, old school, because we have some proteins that kind of hang around. They're called amino acid pools that are in skeletal muscle. And then also when we consume foods, we have digestive enzymes that are, you know, complete proteins that are released into our gut, and those are digested. So those help to buffer, you know, as long as you're eating a variety of proteins across the course of the day. I think where we do get into questions is if you have someone who's really, really training pretty hard And that meal, particularly right after the workout, is really important, you know, to sort of within 20 minutes get in a source of protein as well as some good carbohydrate. It may be, you know, if you're not seeing the benefits that you need, maybe it doesn't hurt to think about getting a complementary protein in during intense training. There's no evidence to support that that would be true or not be true, but really, it's really not all that hard to complement. I think it's things we do naturally anyway, you know, a bean burrito, beans and tortilla, or peanut butter and jelly sandwich, peanut butter on good hearty bread. So it's something to consider, but, you know, I guess to answer it without rumbling on a little bit further is that we really don't know in people who are doing really, really strenuous training.
Okay. And Scott, was that ever an issue for you?
I think it's more of a psychological issue.
Right. Yeah.
Fear, like, oh, you know, it's going to be so hard to get enough protein, and that's the pervading, you know, question that's always asked amongst any vegetarian athlete. Everybody will always say, well, where do you get your protein? And that's true of even a non-athlete, vegetarian or vegan. But it was more of a psychological barrier for me. And as Dr. Larson has mentioned, that, you know, it's really, as long as you're incorporating enough variety in your diet, because, you know, you can eat vegetarian/vegan junk food and, you know, still be a vegan or still be a vegetarian. And for athletes, it's very important to incorporate a wide variety of really whole foods, plant-based, that are, you know, not only protein-rich, but also, you know, vitamin-rich. And for me, it was, I love to eat, and I've always eaten. I have a pretty high metabolism, and I've always eaten a fair amount. So the biggest gap I've seen for vegetarian athletes when the protein issue comes up is caloric intake. And I think Dr. Larson would also agree on that. And that's the bigger issue, especially with, you know, ultra-endurance events or endurance athletes.
So, Ina, do you find that it's an issue for vegans, I'm going to make a statement and say, we'll say vegetarians for now. So we'll include the lacto-ovo vegetarians. We'll include the vegetarians who like to eat fish now and then, and the vegans. I'll just say vegetarians from now on in this show, okay? Do you find that vegetarians have an issue with trying to eat enough calories in the day?
There's a variety of different athletes, and of course we're grouping them into, you know, broad variety of categories. I mean, you know, we're kind of grouping them into one, I guess. Yes, some vegetarians do, and it really sort of depends on, you know, their caloric need. Certainly an endurance athlete doing a lot of training is going to have much higher caloric needs than someone who's just doing some strength training or, you know, aerobic type of stuff a couple times a week. But I think where athletes tend to get into problems is when they sometimes are just choosing, you know, completely whole foods all the time, and, you know, you might have an energy or daily requirements of like 5,000 calories per day or 6,000 and, you know, even up to 3,000. And sometimes it's hard to consume that much on a regular basis if your choices are only, you know, completely whole foods. So it can be an issue for some, but it's not necessarily an issue straight across the board. But I do definitely agree with Scott. The biggest thing is meeting your energy needs, and that's important for protein and, as you said, also minerals and vitamins as well.
And so it's kind of fun, in the beginning of your book, you actually say that it's definitely okay in order to meet your caloric needs. It's okay to eat some processed foods. It's desserts are recommended, and, you know, a little bit more fat in your diet is okay as well. So I think some people might like to hear that it's not so restrictive after all.
Right, healthy desserts and healthy fats.
Yes, healthy desserts. Yeah, let's definitely qualify that. So let's talk
I didn't mean to sound too that everything has to be, you know, whole based. I just see the other side where, you know, some athletes just eliminate everything and find. But I definitely incorporate, you know, those comfort foods or those foods that are, as Dr. Larson is saying, you know, healthy fats, healthy, you know, desserts as well.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people think that the only thing I eat is, like, you know, vegetarian hot dogs and, you know, veggie burgers and all that. But I find that I eat really actually quite a little of that. Maybe like once or twice a week I might have that. But yet I'm teaching about 20 classes a week. So I definitely have to keep my caloric intake quite high. Let's talk about recovery. Scott, you mentioned how important the vegan diet was for your recovery. Maybe you could talk first about how you found that it helps you recover, and then, Annette, maybe you could talk clinically about why that actually happens. So,
okay.
Scott, why did you find the vegan diet helps you recover?
Well, one of the main benefits of a a vegetarian diet is that it's carbohydrate rich. And for endurance athletes, replacing glycogen stores from hard, intense training as well as long endurance training is really essential. And so one of the big advantages that you typically are, you know, consuming large amounts of carbohydrates, which usually ensure that you're replacing and restoring that glycogen in the muscles. The other benefits I found is it's also very vitamin, nutrient-dense foods, assuming that, you know, once again, we're not just eating empty junk food calories. So what I found is that my body repaired quicker. I found that I wasn't as tired the next day following a hard effort, so I could go out and do, you know, back-to-back training that I had mentioned earlier in the show. And so it was really that, you know, key transformation of just finding that, you know, my body bounced back. I haven't had injuries that have set me back, you know, more than a couple days, minor tendonitis. So that's really where I noticed it most.
Yeah, and myself, if I'm really sore, if I've taught five classes in a day and I find that I'm sore the next day, or if I've actually pulled, like, I actually strained my rotator cuff a couple weeks ago, I find that if I just increase my whole foods, if I eat my greens and all that, I recover so much faster than before than when I didn't do that. So, Annette, why is that? Why does that happen?
Well, one of the things that during exercise, I guess a couple things that happens are you get some little what's called microtrauma to your skeletal muscle. And that happens, you know, with endurance training as well as with strength training. And then also, the more energy that we expend kind of as a, I guess you'd say, a byproduct naturally of taking our caloric foods and converting it into ATP and then energy that we can use to when we exercise, you get a little bit of free radicals that are produced. And those can actually damage muscle tissue and they can damage DNA. And our body has some natural defenses that we have to help sort of sequester those or break those down so they don't do other damage. But the vegetarian diet is just really full of those. The natural thing that always comes to mind are the antioxidant vitamins, like vitamin E that protects the fat-soluble portions of our body, like the cells, our cell membranes, and the membranes of our mitochondria, membranes of our muscle. Vitamin C, that's more all of the water-soluble parts, and then beta-carotene, but also some of the phytochemicals that, you know, we really can't get into, really good chemicals that are found in a variety of fruits and vegetables, and it seems like every fruit or vegetable has its own unique set of phytochemicals, and many of those are anti-inflammatory, and many of those are antioxidants. So they help to really sequester and prevent that damage, and there are some studies, pretty recent studies, not in vegetarian athletes, but just in vegetarians, that looked at levels of antioxidant vitamins. And vegetarians indeed have higher levels of vitamin E, vitamin C, and beta-carotene in their blood. So that means that probably it's also higher in their muscle and the rest of their body tissues. And then they didn't even attempt to look at phytochemicals. So that's probably one of the mechanisms that's occurring, and that's actually very exciting. And I love to hear your stories because I definitely have seen that both with myself as well as just people that I've worked with in the lab. We just recover better, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really quite amazing, and it's just through food.
Right.
And I like in your book, too, how you try to de-emphasize taking vitamin supplements and say, well, it might not be just the vitamins that we've localized in these fruits and vegetables, but these fruits and vegetables are combined in such a way that we don't even know why they're so beneficial to us. We just need to eat them.
Right. Science is starting to look a little bit into it. It seems like there's always a paper, this component in that plant food is really good for this. And really, it's very exciting.
Bone health. You have a section on bone health in your book. I want you to talk a little bit about that and why that would be a concern for specifically vegetarian athletes.
Bone health is one of those interesting. It's almost as bad as the protein issue. So, you know, the first question you get is the protein, and then the second question is, particularly if you're vegan, how are you getting calcium?
Calcium, yeah.
And there's a lot of unique things to the vegetarian diet that I think maybe put vegetarians at an advantage. The research has interestingly shown that vegetarians in general, if they consume a lot of dairy products, get adequate calcium and perhaps even have, when you do the bone density comparisons, maybe even have stronger bones than non-vegetarians. there haven't been a lot of studies in vegans, and so it's really kind of a tough issue to cover. I think for vegans, it is important to look at good, well-absorbed sources of calcium and just make those a priority. And just kind of as an example, you know, you always get this, I guess compared to the skeletal muscle, calcium, which is really true with a lot of the minerals in general, you might consume 300 milligrams of calcium or, you know, 300 micrograms of another mineral, but really only a fraction of that is absorbed. And so with the vegetarian diet, you're often sort of fighting making sure that you get well absorbed, that it's well absorbed. So I guess back to my comment on the calcium, about 30% of the calcium from milk is absorbed. But there are a lot of food sources, particularly those greens that actually you mentioned earlier. Rob, bok choy, sort of the Chinese napa cabbages, collards, kale, okra, turnip greens, and then blackstrap molasses. Over 50% of the calcium from those sources are absorbed. There's also some sources, spinach, Swiss chard, some of the milder tasting greens like beets. Those less than 5% of the calcium is absorbed. So it is kind of a consideration, definitely an important consideration for vegans to look at. I really like, if I could just put a plug in, there is a vegetarian pyramid that was developed, I think, by Messina and Mangels.
Okay, yeah, in their vegetarian handbook?
It's in the handbook, and it's also in the Journal of American Dietetic Association. They've actually published that. And the pyramid is, it's a straight-up version. It's not the tipped-over version, but it's 3D. And then at every level of the pyramid, it's actually directed at vegans. They have sort of the 3D is good sources of calcium in each of the groups. And it's a great educational tool to sort of just ensure that you're really making good or choosing good calcium sources from all of the different food groups. But I guess back to the athletes. In addition to calcium, you know, we have vitamin D that's extremely important. We have vitamin K, which is abundant in all of those green leafy vegetables, a lot of fruits and vegetables in general that vegetarians tend to consume more of. And then magnesium as well that may be important. And if you're a vegetarian athlete and eating abundant of those, particularly if your needs are high, you're going to get a lot more nutrients in general than would a non-vegetarian. So I think we're at an advantage that, you know, that's really not out there in the literature, and it would be great to actually really study and put a finger on, you know, that and say, yes, indeed, there is an advantage. So I guess to sort of summarize, you do need to be careful and make sure you're making good food choices for calcium. But on the other hand, I think the vegetarian diet offers a lot of advantages.
Scott, with your endurance running, I imagine some people would think you would develop a lot of stress fractures, if not outright breaks. How has your bone health been?
It's been very good. I think as a physiotherapist, too, I'm maybe at a little bit more of a disadvantage in terms of, you know, knowing how to properly train and balance. And as I mentioned, strength training is very important to really absorb the impact. It's the muscles, it's not the joints that should be absorbing impact. So I've been completely free of stress fractures, and you know, there's a lot of research and evidence too on the caloric intake of athletes and relating that to stress fractures in addition to the calcium. And I've been, as I say, very free of it, although you know, it's a balance of training I guess practices as well as dietary. And you know, then there are definitely individual differences, and you know, female versus male, and other factors. But it's something that I've been free from.
Inet, I want you to talk about the red flag nutrients for vegetarian athletes that you listed. If you could just briefly highlight each of them and why that you've termed them red flag nutrients: zinc, iodine, and copper.
Okay, iron is sort of on there too, as well, but. Zinc is one that we really don't know a lot about. Zinc is not as absorbed from the vegetarian diet. And then also, it's a nutrient that you really need to focus on, again, getting a variety of foods. Zinc is really high in legumes, for example. And in fact, I think, you know, to put in my legume plug, legumes are really high in a lot of the nutrients that tend to be low in the vegetarian diet. They're great foods, variety of them that to be included in the diet kind of as a natural basis, as are whole grains. So with zinc, it's really sort of making a priority for, you know, back again, this plug to meeting your energy needs, and then really choosing a variety of foods, including legumes and whole grains and nuts in your diet, unless, of course, there's an allergy to nuts. Iodine is something a little bit new, and iodine really depends, I think, on where you live. In the U.S., it really isn't as much of a problem, but the iodine content of fruits and vegetables that are grown, particularly vegetables that are grown in the soil, if the soil is lacking in iodine, the vegetables indeed can be low in iodine content. And for individuals who are restricting their sodium intake, either because they think it's really beneficial for their health, or, you know, you tend to also maybe go a little bit overboard, perhaps on the sodium, you know, maybe sodium is bad, so maybe I should eat as less as possible. And then not using the salt shaker, and salt is one of the, or iodized salt is one of our major sources of iodine, particularly in the U.S. and then in other countries. If you get processed foods, or if you're someone who uses sea salt, which is actually what we use at home too, you have to really go out of your way to look for iodized sea salt. Not a lot of sea salts are iodized. I think it's really kind of an important consideration. It's important for athletes, to vegetarian athletes, to meet their iodine needs, but there's also some interesting research that just came out about perchlorates, some pollutants that indeed are in our environment, and if we have low iodine intake along with becoming exposed to perchlorates in our environment, that can actually lead to some problems with low iodine and perhaps low thyroid, circulating levels of thyroid. So it's definitely an important consideration to look at as well. So, you know, really the biggest thing, honestly, is to cut back. If you're cutting back on the processed foods, you have much more control if you actually buy iodized salt and use a little bit of that in your cooking, and then also a little bit of that if you need to salt your food to use that iodized salt.
Okay. For more of the red flag nutrients, I'm going to let listeners pick up your book, Vegetarian Sports Nutrition. We do have to move on. We've got 2 minutes left. And I want to ask you both about proper nutrition before, during, and after a sports event, whether it be, well, I guess it's going to be different if it's a sports event like a 100-mile run or if it's just a common workout. I'm not sure which is the best example to give in terms of laying out this kind of nutrition plan. But and that maybe I'll leave that up to you, what you advise your clients, your typical fit clients, to eat before, during, and after.
I really advise a well-digested source of carbohydrate, something you know, like maybe oatmeal or some whole grain toast with maybe a little bit of low-trans margarine, something that they really, that they can tolerate, that can be digested, ideally about 90 minutes before the workout. During will really depend on if they go longer than an hour or longer than 90 minutes. If it's an intense workout, longer than, definitely longer than an hour. And then that's consuming something well digested as well with water, whatever carbohydrate source with water. And then after is really a period that's ignored that is extremely important. I think after a good workout, within 20 to 30 minutes, you should get a source of carbohydrate and maybe a little bit of protein as well. Protein's more of a priority if you're doing strength training exercises, and then if you're doing endurance, and like Scott said earlier, and you want to replace that glycogen, it's really important to get in carbohydrate.
And Scott, let me ask you, before, during, and after such a big sports event that you engage in, what do you consume?
Well, I'd have to agree with Dr. Meyer on everything. I also do, I've found over the last few years that a lower residue type of diet, or one that's easier to absorb, typically before an event is best, so I include things like smoothies and, like she was mentioning before, high fiber intake, you know, is not only an issue in terms of just getting it in, but also digestion. So I actually go to the more processed grains or foods right before an event so that that gets digested well. So the meal, you know, the night before an event, I'll use white rice or, you know, whereas normally that would be brown rice. So I found that to basically get through my system and be digested quicker so that I'm not having issues with, you know, digestion. During the event, I go by body weight typically, and I'll go anywhere from 0.7 times the kilogram body weight up to 1.0 times the kilogram body weight. And for me, that's anywhere from 55 grams of carbohydrate on up to 75, 80 grams of carbohydrate per hour. And, you know, I'm consuming then, of course, water with that, depending upon the environment that I'm in. And anywhere from, you know, 20, 40 ounces, or in a race like Badwater, it can be as high as, you know, 50 ounces of water or more an hour, and then also electrolytes, too. And then post-event, it's really important. I've kind of used the guideline of 1.5 times the kilogram body weight would equal your grams of carbohydrate that you should consume within 20 to 30 minutes, and then somewhere around 0.3 times the kilogram body weight for protein. So I'm getting anywhere from, you know, 15 to 20 grams of protein in with my carbohydrate.
We are completely out of time. Yannette, I wonder if I could post your fluid replacement beverage recipe on our website?
Sure.
Yeah, because I think that's a good one if people don't want to purchase these sports drinks that are on the market. And I'll give you 30 seconds to say your best advice for vegetarian athletes out there.
I think the best advice is to eat a variety of foods, and I think the biggest thing is to meet your energy needs and just know that there's a lot of benefits out there that we can't really measure in science, and I think, you know, Scott's definitely attest to that, and I am as well.
Definitely. All right, the book is Vegetarian Sports Nutrition, which you wrote, and Scott, you wrote a great foreword to as well, and I'd like to wish you both very happy holidays. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you very much.
And take care to all our listeners. You can visit us at animalvoices.ca. This show should be archived within the next couple of days, and we'll see you next week.